This is Tom Roy with radio news from Waveform's WGXC in New York. News about radio waves, transmission art, wireless surveillance, and other broadcast issues from wavefarm.org. This is Tom Roy reporting radio news about radio waves. This week, the new FCC chairman Tom Wheeler named his staff, none of them with a broadcast background. He named Ruth Milkman his chief of staff. She's currently chief of the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. Philip Verveer was named senior counselor to the chairman. He's a former United States coordinator for international communications and information policy at the State Department and practiced communications and antitrust law for 35 years. At the FCC, he was the chief of the Cable Television Bureau, the Broadcast Bureau, and the Common Carrier Bureau. Gigi B. Sohn joins Wheeler's staff as special counsel for external affairs. She has been president and CEO of Public Knowledge, an open internet advocacy organization. She was also co-chair of the board of directors of the Broadband Internet Technical Advisory Group. Diane Cornell was named the chairman's special counsel. She was vice president for government affairs at MRSAT and also the vice president of regulatory policy at the CTIA, the Wireless Lobbying Group. She's also worked as legal advisor to three FCC commissioners, has had various other previous FCC jobs. Also on the commission staff are John Salet, the interim director of Technology Transitions Policy Task Force, John Wilkins, the acting managing director and advisor to the chairman for management, with Roger Sherman, who becomes the acting chief of Wireless Telecommunications Bureau, the bureau that oversees amateur radio at the FCC. Paul Brinsmondale at Radiosurvivor.com analyzes Wheeler's interview with Broadcasting and Cable, where he tried to set broadcasters at ease over the lack of appointments. He said that, quote, broadcasters fulfill an important public service. The broadcasters distribute in many ways now, including over the air. And in a world in which we now have a digital pathways rather than analog pathways, the issue is, what is the most efficient use of the spectrum? And that doesn't mean chucking broadcasting, unquote.
Want to take a ride? From the high desert and the great American Southwest, exclusively on Sirius XM Radio, this is Dark Matter with your host, Art Bell. Now, here's Art.
Actually, spooky matter this night, ladies and gentlemen, spooky matter. You have sent me ghost stories. My board op in D.C., that's where he is, by the way, Washington, D.C., Evan, is, may call you. And if so, we will we'll definitely talk to you about your ghost story, and we got some good ones, too. And we will scatter that in with open line ghost stories. Now, not yet with the open lines, but we will get to that, I guarantee. It's a long night. 4 hours is a lot of show with as few breaks as we ever have.
Art Bell is leaving Sirius XM satellite radio after just a month and a half on the air. The 68-year-old was the co-creator of Coast to Coast AM for 15 years and retired in 2003. Since then, George Norrie has taken over Coast to Coast AM, but this summer, Sirius XM radio, satellite radio announced that Bell would launch a new show, a new nightly call-in show, Art Bell's Dark Matter, in September. Fans of the occult, conspiracy theories, and more have long tuned in to Bell and Coast to Coast and had been much anticipating his return to some sort of airwaves. But that ended just after that Halloween broadcast, and now Art Bell's website has the following statement. Quote, while passionate satellite radio fans may not want to hear it, his reasons for leaving boiled down to three main things. Sirius XM's web player was notoriously unreliable, causing a loss of subscribers and a degraded listening experience for those who remain listening online. Two, for a caller-driven show, the caller pool for Art's show is just too small. Three, international listeners have no legitimate way to hear the show. Sirius refused to set up a web stream, and that led to pirate broadcasts of Art Bell's Dark Matter in the way that there are sometimes pirate broadcasts of Howard Stern's satellite-only radio show. You can go to Art Bell's Dark Matter website, or Lee Spiegel has a report at the Huffington Post. On November 5th, 2013, the Federal Communications Commission issued an enforcement advisory alerting radio stations to the laws governing the appropriate use of emergency alert system codes. There have been several recent incidents where radio stations have inadvertently or not played emergency alert system alerts when there were no emergencies. Amateur Radio Newsline reports that Turner Broadcasting just got a $25,000 notice of apparent liability for using simulated emergency alert system tones in an ad for the Conan O'Brien show. The FCC also reached a resolution with MMK License, which owns WNKY in Bowling Green, Kentucky. In that case, the station used a simulated EAS signal in an advertisement for the Fanware and More store, and that cost the station $39,000. Earlier in 2013, the movie Olympus Has Fallen used a short burst of emergency alert systems tones as part of its No Surrender trailer that aired on several radio stations. Two radio goodbyes this week. The New York Times reports that Bill Mazur, a sports fixture in New York City radio, died at the age of 92 on October 22nd.
Bill Mazur died today. You probably didn't know him. Your life as a sports fan, however, was utterly changed by him. Mine certainly was. He was the man, the first man to succeed on radio in a big city in this country, simply talking sports with listeners who phoned in. Bill Mazur was sports talk in Buffalo originally, and then starting nearly half a century ago here in New York City. Like it or hate it, pretty much started with him, and it didn't get much better than him.
Yeah, well, you know, he had that little, first of all, he was older, so he had this fatherly touch with the players. And, you know, he had a couple of, if you remember, he loved Rick Pitino. He was unbelievably enamored with Rick when he was coaching. Rick was coaching then, the Knicks, and he was in love with Rick Pitino, in love with him. Ed Mohegan, what's up, Ed?
Hello, Mike. How are you?
Good.
You know, it's funny. I got in the car and I heard that Bill Mazur died, and I hadn't heard his name in so long. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm 47, mm-hmm. and I remember him, you know, back in the late 70s and early 80s for me. And one of the things about him was you didn't have to be a sports fan to know his name. You know, you could just be a regular person, not into sports, and
right.
you knew who Bill Mazur was.
Well, because he was on the news every night, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, but you knew. You know, I mean, there's a lot of guys on the news now that do sports that people just don't know.
Right, that's true.
Mazur had covered sports in New York at radio and television stations from March 1964 through 2009. Also leaving radio this week, Tom Sharpling announced that his program on Tuesdays on WFMU called The Best Show on WFMU.
I guess I can tell everybody that I said I was going to make an announcement, and I am going to make an announcement. You know, I joke around about a lot of stuff, and I've joked around about this before, and I'm not joking around about it now. I just, you know, I've been doing the show for 13 years now. Started doing it in 2000, and the show has become definitely the best thing that has ever happened to me, comedically. In any way to be able to do things. It's one of the most special things that has ever happened in my life to get to be a part of a thing like this that means so much to so many people. It's really special that this show has kind of grown into the thing that it's grown into. The other part of that, though, is that it has basically grown into something that has turned into more or less a full-time job. And that is something that I never foresaw with the show. And it's been exciting, but it also is, it's hard to try to put all your creative energy out there, and look, I'm a little rambly right now, so I think you can understand that. It is a huge commitment, and there are realities that go with certain things, and it's hard to do something that's more or less a full-time job for free, and I've done it for as long as I can do it, and the hard part of it is that I know it's time. The reality of this, I cannot sustain my life and this show and the commitment that this show takes to do right. And I can't do it, and John can't do it. John Worster can't do it. We've talked about it, and I've talked about this with the station, and we understand everybody's on the same page with this, and they understand where I'm coming from.
We'll broadcast its final episode on December 17th. Sharpling teams with sometimes comedy partner and Superchunk drummer John Worster, comedians like Patton Oswalt and John Hodgman will call in or appear on The Best Show on WFMU. You can go to fmu.org for more information about The Best Show on WFMU. Vox Novus and Harvest Works, two arts groups, are inviting composers and sound artists to submit recorded works as 5.1 audio sound works of 60 seconds or less in duration to be included in a special 60 by 60 project in New York City. The deadline is December 1st, and all works should be 1 minute in length and prepared for 5.1 audio playback. 60 by 60 is a one-hour-long show made by sequencing the 60 pre-recorded pieces by 60 different composers, each a minute in length or shorter. The works will be presented by Harvest Works in spring of 2014. You can go to 60x60.com for more information or check out the Harvest Works website. The first week of October, Art Gallery iBeam in New York City hosted Prism Breakup, a series of art and technology events dedicated to exploring and providing forms of protection from surveillance. Artists, hackers, academics, activists, security analysts, and journalists were at the week-long series of workshops and art installations. On Saturday, November 30th, WGXC in the Hudson Valley will air 11 recordings from the Prism Breakup workshops, including Ingrid Burrington's The Architecture of Surveillance.
Concerned about it are, one, I personally switched to this myself. I still use Gmail, but I actually use Thunderbird, which is an open source application that downloads my email. So I don't actually store anything on a server that's more than a certain amount old. Yes, no, it's there for time. But actually, sorry, that 180 days, there is a higher burden of evidence required to get more recent email. So it's generally, it is in some cases a warrant if it's less than 180 days old, which is why that time off is significant, potentially.
Amelia Marzik, Signal Strength.
I guess I wanted to talk about, like, where this came from in the first place and, you know, why I got interested in privacy. And this story is probably not very cool, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So a few years ago, I was working for a large company, and we had a 20-page contract and a strict non-compete agreement. But because I can't behave myself, I got involved with a small group of folks that were sort of hell-bent on creating a location-based phone app that was obviously in breach of our contract. So the plan was pretty classic. We were going to get a prototype together, quit our jobs, get VC funding, and take over the world. So as we were working towards this, the level of paranoia became super intense. So I guess, you know, we were instructed not to talk about the project, even behind closed doors, because there were rumors that there were microphones planted in all the offices. Not to mention sending any related emails within the building or using specific computers, phones, printers, basically any hardware that belonged to the company. So the group would, like, you know, sort of like word of mouth, and then would meet several blocks away from the office.
Dan Pfeiffer's Small Wi-Fi Networks Loosely Joined.
Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about my project Occupy.here, just starting from the beginning. Started at Occupy Wall Street about 2 years ago. I was making it down to the occupation and talking to a lot of people and taking it all in. And I was struck by this social situation that encouraged a kind of stranger-to-stranger interaction that you don't encounter very much in a city. And it kind of reminded me of an IRC channel. For those of you who are nerdy enough to use IRC on a regular basis still, this is just a group chat. It's all text-based, and there's a thing that you use in an IRC channel when you can't be there all the time, which is called an IRC bot. And IRC bots do lots of different things, but one of the things they do is they just idle in the channel and record all the activity that's happening. And so I thought, like, maybe I could build a physical IRC bot for Zuccotti Park. This was kind of the genesis of the idea.
Brian House's open pass.
Some of my interests, you know, are human geography, and I, you know, like many of the people in the room, also data and how data and everyday life feed back into each other and what the implications are and what's happening in our current political climate. Today I'm going to talk about a project called Open Paths, and this is something that I had a part in developing at the New York Times R&D Lab together with Jer Thorpe and Jake Porway. And there's a disclaimer here. It is a New York Times project, but the views expressed here are my own and not those of the Times. And I'm going to come at this from, I think, a slightly different angle than, you know, what we've been talking about so far, in that OpenPass is not, it's not a tool to protect against surveillance in any sense, but it's an attempt to facilitate a reframing of the value of data, which I think is related. And as artists and technologists, that's a certain, you know, a different strategy of resistance that's available to us, you know, whatever infrastructure it is that we're dealing with.
And Helen Nissenbaum's DIY privacy and obfuscation.
Just the principle of obfuscation that I believe today, maybe more than ever, is an approach to protecting privacy and what I call DIY privacy that is, you know, in these moments where we're learning that encryption systems have been compromised, this is a moment in which I believe obfuscation should be practiced and should be, and as a professor, I'm interested for us to really study it more.
Go to WGXC.org for more information about Prism Breakup broadcasts November 30th on WGXC. WGXC also has a special broadcast on Saturday, November 16th. The Social Space of Sound was recorded at the Museum of Modern Art on October 16th, 2013. It was a public program organized in conjunction with the Soundings, a Contemporary Score exhibition of sound art that's currently up at the Museum of Modern Art. Participants included Philip Brophy, writer, composer, and film director, Christopher Cox, professor of philosophy at the Hampshire College and a faculty member at the Center for Curatorial Studies at Bard College, Johanna Fateman, musician, writer, and record producer and member of the band La Tigra, and it was moderated by Barbara London, the associate curator at the Museum of Modern Art, who put together the Soundings show.
So Soundings, I think, is this exhibition is something of a watershed for sound art. It's an exhibition of sound art works at what is, you know, pretty obviously America's, you know, sort of major museum of contemporary art, major museum of modern art. And but this interest in sound art has been, I think, increasing over the past two decades, maybe the past 15 years or so, at least in the U.S. And one question is, why is it that, and this is a question that I think often arises, why is it that sound art, which has been around since the late 1960s, has become of recent interest to galleries, museums, critics? And I think that there are a number of important historical and philosophical reasons for this, and I'm going to try to point to them, as I said, probably too quickly, and I'll put things on the screen that will probably remain there for about 3 seconds. So anyway, just bear with me, and we can always go back to those in the conversation later. So I want to talk about some of those philosophical and art historical reasons. Sound art, of course, has a lineage in experimental music. Key figures like Luigi Russolo, of course, the Italian futurist, Pierre Schaeffer, decades later in Paris in the late 1940s, and of course John Cage. But I think as an intervention in the visual arts, sound art really begins in the late 1960s with the work of, say, Max Neuhaus in the late 60s, with Marianne Amichet. Again, these are just signposts here. Some images will remain on screen for more than 2 seconds. Alvin Lucier and Lamont Young, just to name a couple of these key figures. And I think sound art emerged within the milieu of minimalist and post-minimalist practices in the visual arts. That challenged kind of key modernist notions such as that of aesthetic autonomy, medium specificity, and the purity of the visual or the optical. And it strikes me that Post-minimalism's challenge to these key features of modernism, out of which sound art emerged, led to two very different paths for art, and in many ways led to a set of paths away from the object and away from objecthood. I'll come back to objects in a second. One of these paths, of course, was conceptual art, which pursued what Lucy Lepard famously called the dematerialization of the art object, presenting the artwork as a concept or an idea to be communicated generally by way of language or discourse. And what I want to argue too briefly here, but we can talk about it, is that there's a kind of implicit idealism in conceptual art that I think is really countered by sound art in a lot of ways. So just to give some key signposts here, two important works by Joseph Kosuth. Of course, Lawrence Wiener's famous statements presented as sentences, as ideas. And I won't spend a lot of time on this, but I think you fairly quickly see the emphasis on the idea and a sort of move, a shift away from kind of any sort of materiality of the work of art. Two quick quotations. But I think a very different response, response to modernism and a kind of shift away from the objects can be discerned in works that went in the opposite direction, in a kind of very materialist direction, pursuing a conception of matter that extends beyond the limited domains of kind of ordinary middle-sized objects, paintings and sculptures, for example. A notion of matter understood as a sort of profusion of fluxes. So we find works like Robert Barry's sculpture using that most ephemeral of all sort of materials, steam. Robert Smithson's interest in sort of process and sculpture via gravity. A figure like Michael Asher, to some degree a conceptualist, but really interested in working with materials and often sound in complex ways. Here, a proposal for a piece, one of several pieces involving columns of air. So, again, an interest in material things that are not objects. Finally, two quick pieces. I love these photographs, right? These photographs of invisible gases. But also Robert Barry, the idea that one might make a sculpture out of a gaseous material that's invisible, but nonetheless has a form, perhaps an invisible one. Barry also started to work, very sort of key conceptualist, started to work in the late 60s with other kinds of invisible things, some of them sound or sound-like entities, things on the sort of sound end of the electromagnetic spectrum. Here, piece using carrier waves, that is the signals that carry, say, radio signals, which would have been audible by way of a receiver. Again, a number of artists at this time interested in art as exploring a broad conception of matter. And it's out of this, I think, that sound art emerges. Some of these artists were interested both in the sort of idea end and the matter end. One of the issues, I think, is that so much of the conceptual work was bolstered by a set of really powerful theories that emerged in the 1960s. Of course, approaches such as post-structuralism, deconstruction, psychoanalysis, and earlier phenomenology, which insisted that our access to reality is either mediated by or constituted by discourse or the idea of the conceptual frameworks, mental entities. And during the 1980s, these theories became really powerful ways of reading texts and images, and sound was left without sound, and these sort of more material works were left without a kind of robust conceptual framework or theoretical framework, such that they were considered at most sort of bizarre incursions into the visual, and at least sort of something else that belongs in some other domain, perhaps music. So conceptual art, I think, became a dominant concern for art historians and critics and curators, while sound art remained a sort of you know, a sort of curiosity, remains certainly a marginal practice. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the emergence of powerful realist and materialist philosophies, which challenge, I think, some of the key features of those art discourses that have been so prominent over the last several decades, again, post-structuralism, deconstruction, psychoanalysis, etc., these bunch of powerful realist and materialist philosophies have been have emerged in kind of coordination with, or at least in resonance with, a return of interest in the sonic.
You can go to WGXC.org for more information about the broadcast of The Social Space of Sound, recorded at MoMA October 16th and broadcast on November 16th. This week in radio history. On November 14th, 1922, the British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, began its domestic radio service on 2LO in London.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
On November 15th, 1926, the National Broadcasting Corporation, NBC, made its first network broadcast.
The circle, like the network, will kindly pull itself together. Carey?
Present.
You were instructed last week to find out the whole truth about those bells. Have you done so?
I have.
Out with it then, Beeble.
Well, okay, Ronnie. Now look, the bell notes serve as a cue to operators all over the country to switch circuits in order that local stations can give out their call letters, you see? And that has to be done because of regulations for the public good, made and enforced by the Federal Communications Commission. I have a copy of that regulation right here, Mr. President.
Well, let's hear it, Carey. I think we ought to get to the bottom of this thing.
Okay, Bobby. Licensee of a broadcast station shall announce the call letters and location as frequently as practicable during hours of operation. And in any event before or after each program being broadcast. In no event shall more than 30 minutes elapse between such announcements. And insofar as practicable, these announcements shall be made on the hour and half hour. These requirements are waived when such announcements would interrupt a single consecutive speech, play, symphony concert, or operatic production of longer duration than 30 minutes. And in such cases, the announcement of the call letters and location shall be made as soon as possible.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.